Radio Derb is on the air. At least we hope we are. Hurricane Earl is roaring up the coast towards Buckley Towers as I speak. And I have my nimble research assistants taping up the windows as a precaution. Careful there on that stepladder, Mandy. And guys, it only needs one of you to hold the ladder, okay? Thank you. Okay, this is your meteorologically genial host, John Derbyshire, hoping to get our broadcast out to the breathlessly waiting world before the storm hits. So, here's the news from this past 7 days. As a dog returneth to his vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly. The fool here is the American presidency, considered for these purposes as a single corporate personality, currently incarnated in one Barack H. Obama. The folly is the Middle East peace process, in aid of which the president is playing host to the Prime Minister of Israel, the President for Life of Egypt, the King of Jordan, and Mahmoud Abbas, former KGB stoolie and butler to Yasser Arafat. There was a picture of them all at dinner with Obama in my Thursday morning newspaper, with Hillary Clinton and Tony Blair thrown in for good measure. In the picture, Benjamin Netanyahu is listening intently, chin on folded hands, to something Obama is saying. I couldn't help wondering what was going through Netanyahu's mind. 60 years old, born and spent most of his life in a small nation under daily threat of annihilation, veteran of combat and elite unit operations, 30 years of total immersion in Middle Eastern politics, a lifetime of fighting with guns and bombs and arguments and politics for the survival of his people. And here he is, listening attentively to Barack Obama, pampered product of the most remote, most secure nation in the world, privileged child of the affirmative action regime, who was never in his life in the same room as a uniformed military man, until his first meeting with the Joint Chiefs a year and a half ago, and whose views on the Middle East, insofar as he had any, were on loan from the Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Last year's conference in Africa on racism, which the United States would not participate in because somebody dared to point out the racism which still supports both here and in Israel. I say that dirty word again. Every time you say Israel, Negroes get awfully quiet on you because they scared. Don't be scared. You don't see the connection between 9-1-1-0-1 and the Israeli-Palestinian? Something wrong. You want to buy my glasses?
Tell it, preacher. If that's not divine inspiration, I don't know what is. But back to Obama and Netanyahu. The last time Bibi showed up at the White House, he was asked to leave by the service entrance, lest anyone should think that Obama approved of that cracker, racist, bloodsucker country of his. Now, here he is, chin on hands, while Obama blows hot gusts of hope and change in his face. It'll all come to nothing, of course. The Arabs want Israel to stop existing, and the Israelis are not in a mood to oblige. Obama wants them to withdraw from the West Bank, but the Israelis aren't going to do that either. Why should they? In the pithy words of Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday, quote, "We left Lebanon, we got terror. We left Gaza, we got terror." End quote. What does anyone think will happen if they leave the West Bank? And while Bibi could do without the terror, he's not actually in fear of the Arabs. He knows a thing that Barack Obama perhaps doesn't know, that the Arabs use terror because they haven't been able to put a decent army together since the 9th century. If it wasn't for the sheer geological good luck of Gulf oil money, the Arabs wouldn't even be players in Islam, the religion their ancestors invented. The important Islamic powers of today are Pakistan, Iran, and Turkey. One's got the bomb, one's about to get it, and one will be getting it just as soon as NATO disintegrates in a crash of devaluing dollars. Or around 6 months from now. I doubt that Bibi spends 5 minutes a week worrying about the Arabs. They're a nuisance, not a threat. Losers, not players. Oh, just let me add a footnote to all that. I started out this segment by calling the American presidency a fool for pursuing this fantasy peace process over several decades. I need to exclude George W. Bush from that. I tossed a few barbs at W. when he was president, but I'll say this for the guy. He was smart enough to walk a wide circle around the Middle East snake pit. Unfortunately, Obama's not that smart. I just posed the rhetorical question there. What does anyone think will happen if Israel leaves the West Bank? Just in case there's any doubt about the answer, a squad of Arab terrorists murdered 4 unarmed people Tuesday, 2 men and 2 women, as they rode in the family car on a public highway in the West Bank. One of the murdered women was pregnant. News of these murders was greeted with great rejoicing by Hamas. That's the faction that's supported by most Palestinian Arabs. The Hamas voters came out into the streets, dancing and singing, handing out candy to the kids. Reuters reports that, quote, Hamas's armed wing, Izz-el-Din al-Qassam, said in a statement that it took full responsibility for the heroic operation in Hebron, end quote. Yes, to the people that Netanyahu's up against, shooting an unarmed pregnant woman is heroic. I just looked up the Hamas website, www.palestine-info.co.uk, to see what they're saying about it today. Quote, Hamas movement strongly denounced. Whoa, wait a minute. They're strongly denouncing the shooting of a pregnant woman? That's great. Oh, no, not exactly. They strongly denounced the frenzied arrest campaign being carried out by the Palestinian Authority's security militias in the West Bank in search of the resistance fighters who carried out the Al-Khalil operation on Tuesday, describing it as a national crime. End quote. That's what it says. Hamas strongly denounces not the murder of innocents, but the half-hearted attempts by Mahmoud Abbas's police to catch the murderers, who are not murderers, but resistance fighters, and who did not carry out an act of shameless multiple murder, but an operation. The police effort to arrest the murderers is a national crime. And somebody thinks that Benjamin Netanyahu is going to hand over the entire West Bank and half of Jerusalem, too, to these psychopaths? Oh, yeah, that'll happen. Still, you'll get your picture, Mr. President. You know, the one where you stand between an Israeli prime minister and the Arabs' latest Jew killer in chief, favouring them with a warm, avuncular smile as they shake hands and smile at each other through gritted teeth. Hurry up and get it over with so we won't have to hear about the damn fool peace process for another administration or two. Hey, come on, you've already got your peace prize. Chutzpah of the week. Is that right? Chutzpah. Chutzpah of the week comes from Jorge Castaneda, who was Mexico's foreign minister under Vicente Fox, 2000 to 2003. Recall that last week, 72 people were executed by gunmen in northern Mexico. These were would-be illegal immigrants into the USA from Ecuador. They'd come up through Honduras and then Guatemala to Mexico, and they were just 100 miles from Texas when they were spotted by a drug gang. The gang herded them into a nearby ranch, tied them all up, and demanded that they serve as drug mules to take narcotics into the USA. When the Ecuadorians refused, the gunmen shot them. 58 men and 14 women. 2 people survived somehow. Now, whose fault was this horrible massacre? To whom should we attribute blame? Answer from Jorge Castaneda: the USA! Yes, folks, this atrocity was all the fault of us gringos, according to this Mexican scholar. Did I mention that he is currently the Distinguished Professor of Politics and Latin American Studies at New York University? Quote from him, quote, "Many are at fault, the sending countries incapable of providing work to their people, the Mexican authorities who have neglected the southern border and internal immigration for decades, but most of all, the United States, which, by refusing to adapt its laws to reality, just changes that reality for the worse into horror." End quote. Remember Menachem Begin's great quote after the Lebanese army murdered Palestinians? "Goyim kill Goyim, and they blame the Jews." Well, you can update that, courtesy of Distinguished Professor Castaneda. Mexicans kill Ecuadorians, and they blame America. Mind you, when it comes to blaming America, Americans themselves are no slouches. Was there ever in the history of the world a nation that seemed to dislike itself as much as the USA does? That's the thought that I was thinking round about the middle of this week. It's not a charitable thought, and possibly it sounds outrageous to patriotic Radio Derb listeners. Just give me a chance to explain why I was thinking it. Start with last Saturday. The big event of Saturday was, of course, Glenn Beck's rally in Washington, D.C. I liked the idea of the rally, and I liked the rally itself as it went off, though I wasn't really paying very close attention to the speeches from the platform. A couple of days later, reading through reports of some of those speeches, my enthusiasm curdled. Here, for example, is some sky pilot named the Reverend Paul Jaley giving the opening prayer on Saturday. Quote, "It was you, Lord God, who called us to account when we broke the treaties with the first peoples. You called us to repentance when we did not live up to our creed and we did not treat everyone as equal." End quote. Then Alveda King, niece of Martin Luther King, stepped up to say that she hopes, quote, "white privilege will become human privilege," and that America will, quote, "soon repent of the sin of racism and return itself to honor." White privilege? What the hell is that supposed to mean? Just 6 weeks ago, we got a study from 2 Princeton sociologists of admission policies at 8 highly competitive private colleges and universities. Permit me to quote from that study. Quote, "To have the same chance of gaining admission as a black student with an SAT score of 1100... a Hispanic student, otherwise equally matched in background characteristics, would have to have a 1230. A white student would have to have a 1410, and an Asian student a 1550. End quote. White privilege? Come again? Then Glenn Beck himself came forward too, and this was the keynote of the meeting, restore America's honor. Why does it need restoring? Beck told us, quote, "Let's be honest. If you look at history, America has been both terribly good and terribly bad. Countries make mistakes. We have made more than our fair share." End quote. More than our fair share? Compared with whom? No doubt America's done wrong things, but do we have to dwell on them quite so much? Even at a rally whose theme is supposed to be patriotism? Well, that was Saturday. Sunday, the Derb family was at a loose end, so we all went to see the movie Avatar, which none of us had caught the first time around, and which was playing at a local super-duper IMAX 3D state-of-the-art movie theatre. Message of the movie, in case you haven't seen it. Capitalism is evil, the military is evil, the USA is evil, and barbarism is morally superior to civilization. Then, on Monday, we got the news that our State Department, the US State Department, had submitted a report to the United Nations Human Rights Commission boasting of the administration's legal jihad against the voters of Arizona, and implicitly against the 63% of citizens nationwide who agree with them. Now, that Hillary Clinton's State Department regards 63% of us as knuckle-dragging morons is not very surprising. Nor is it news that Hollywood movie directors hate capitalism and the military and cling to the myth of the noble savage, long after that myth has been completely discredited by historians and anthropologists. That a large portion of this country's cultural, political and intellectual elites look down on the rest of us with scorn and contempt is pretty well known. But look, it's not just the elites. Avatar was a huge commercial success. Glenn Beck's rally was a big success too. 500,000 people showed up to wallow in our national guilt. And while 63% of us may have ticked the yes box on a poll about the Arizona law, the invasion of our country by foreign scofflaws is way down the list of people's concerns. It hasn't swung a single important election, as the open borders lobbyists gleefully remind us. Probably most Americans think that, as bad as it is, we deserve it because of what Glenn Beck calls those terribly bad things our great-grandfathers did. Well, some of our great-grandfathers. Well, some of your great-grandfathers. Mine were minding sheep and digging coal in England on starvation wages. Now, certainly it's a good thing to be self-critical. We should all pause from time to time to reflect on our own shortcomings and try to improve ourselves. And as for individuals, so also for nations. I wouldn't advocate Americans being like the Chinese or Japanese, who have to have their thumbs put in a vice before they will admit to their nation ever having done anything wrong at all. Occasional, thoughtful self-criticism is good. There is a right measure for all things, though. Do we have to wallow in guilt like this? Even when being entertained at the movie theatre? Even when gathered at the Lincoln Memorial for a patriotic pep rally? There's something unhealthy going on here, something grovelling and abject, a collective masochism, a reflexive self-flagellation. And it's a mass phenomenon, not just the elites. To be perfectly frank, I find it a little creepy. Can we please all stop apologising so much? If disliking your own country isn't wacky enough, here's a guy who dislikes the entire human race. Here was a guy, I mean. James J. Lee was shot dead by a police sniper while waving a handgun at hostages he'd taken in the Discovery Channel's headquarters building, which is in Silver Spring, Maryland. He left behind an online manifesto in which he said, amongst other things, quote, "Humans are the most destructive, filthy, pollutive creatures around and are wrecking what's left of the planet with their false morals and breeding culture," end quote. Such opinions are not as rare as you might think. There is actually an organisation called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement, whose programme is, and I quote here from their website at vhemt.com, quote, "Phasing out the human race by voluntarily ceasing to breed will allow Earth's biosphere to return to good health. Crowded conditions and resource shortages will improve as we become less dense," end quote. Now, please don't think that I'm slandering the good folk at VHEMT by association with James Lee. They want the human race to move towards extinction in a peaceful and orderly way by ceasing to breed. He wanted to speed the process along some with a handgun and some homemade explosive devices. They're both out at the furthest end of the environmentalist spectrum, but the VHEMT people are sane. Or at least sane-ish, while Lee was plainly as crazy as a coot. Though why that rather nondescript-looking waterfowl should be the archetype of craziness, I have never understood. It ought to be a well-established principle that you can't deduce anything at all from a lone act of insanity. But when you have an axe to grind, the temptation can be irresistible. Thus, the Southern Poverty Law Centre, which has done such a wonderful job of alleviating poverty among its own board members, Maurice Deese, the SPLC director, pays himself well north of $300,000 a year. The SPLC noted gleefully that James Lee belonged to that splinter group of environmentalists who think that mass immigration is bad for the environment. And therefore, people who want restrictions on immigration must be crazy hostage-taking gunmen. I think that was the argument. Then David Klinghoffer at the Discovery Institute, which is a creationist think tank, chimed in with the observation that James Lee seems to have believed in the preposterous and utterly discredited theories of Charles Darwin, along with fellow Darwinists Charles Manson, Mao Tse-tung, Joseph Stalin, Joseph Mengele, and of course Adolf Hitler. That doesn't quite compute. Wouldn't a Darwinist wish for his species to be successful, not to go extinct? But no doubt the Discovery Institute people can discover a response to that. It'll be interesting to see who else tries to squeeze some propaganda mileage out of this nutcase. According to his online manifesto, Lee was not merely an immigration restrictionist and a Darwinist, but also a pacifist. Quote, "All programs promoting war and the technology behind those should cease." So, perhaps we should be fingering Mahatma Gandhi and Mother Teresa here, as well as old Chuck Darwin. Oh, and look at this one. Item number 4 on his manifesto, quote, "Civilization must be exposed for the filth it is." Well, I thought that that Avatar movie already took care of that, but perhaps James Lee didn't get round to seeing it. President Obama made a speech declaring the end of the Iraq War. I don't know, I miss the old days when Democrats got us into wars and Republicans got us out of them. What was wrong with that arrangement? The world's turned upside down. But there you are, it's useless to hanker for the past. Anyway, Obama thinks that our work in Iraq is done, except for some non-combat stuff, like training Iraqi troops and preventing the Iraqis from lynching their corrupt, useless politicians. It all brings to mind that famous quote from, I think it was Everett Dirksen, in the middle of the Vietnam War, that we should just declare victory and then pull out. That's pretty much what we're doing with Iraq. 3 or 4 years from now, the place will turn into a fratricidal bloodbath, followed by an invasion from Iran. But by that time, American unemployment will be at 60%, the Dow will be at 300, the dollar will be trading at a trillion to the Chinese renminbi, and hungry citizens will be fleeing the cities to beg from farmers and grub for roots in the woodlands. So nobody will give a fig about Iraq. So, mission accomplished. Closer at hand, we have the November elections and Obama's strategy for re-election in 2012. The speech, with its salutes to the military and its generous words even for George W. Bush, tells us which way Obama's political strategy is trending. Having heard words like that, coming out of the mouth of their erstwhile hero and saviour, the lefty peacenik types who turned out en masse for Obama in 08 will stay home this November, making the midterms even more of a catastrophe for the Democrats. Republicans will take the House, and likely the Senate too. Plainly, Obama doesn't care. His gamble is that the Republicans will then spend 2 years doing what they do so well, shooting themselves repeatedly in the foot and the ankle, the knee, the hip, the backside, the arm, the shoulder, and any major organ they can locate, while the president soars loftily above it all, once again the healer and uniter, murmuring soothing platitudes while those grubby politicians bicker and fight. Given the track record of modern republicanism, it's not a bad bet. Not for nothing are we called the stupid party. So, having thrown his mentor, his pastor, his grandmother and his wife under the bus, remember when he ordered the release of Michelle's airhead senior college thesis, just to stop people speculating about it? Having thrown all them under the bus, now Barack Obama has thrown the pacifist left under the bus too. It's amazing that bus can still move. There are so many corpses under it. Time for some mosque news. We're finally getting some dribs of information about the financing of the Ground Zero Mosque. Everybody involved seems to be a sleazeball third world bazaar huckster. They all have track records as slumlords, tax evaders, welfare scam artists, and donators to terrorist outfits. What a surprise. What an almighty frickin' surprise. Meanwhile, mosque news is breaking out all over. Carlton, New York, is a town so small it's not shown in my Rand McNally Road Atlas, but Google tells me it's up there all right on Route 98 west of Rochester. Well, small it may be, but Carlton has a mosque. Prayers at the Carlton Mosque were disturbed one evening recently by two vehicles honking their horns outside. The vehicles turned out to contain teenage males, who yelled obscenities at congregants who came out to complain. One of the teens then fired a shotgun in the air. Five teenagers have been charged with disrupting a religious service, which is a misdemeanor. The mosque-goers of Carlton are grumbling that it took sheriff's deputies 40 minutes to show up. Well, perhaps they couldn't find the place. Then, in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, just south of Nashville, Muslims recently got approval to build a new mosque. The proposed site of the mosque has been repeatedly vandalized, and last Saturday someone set fire to a dump truck parked at the site. Pretty terrifying stuff, eh? Speaking personally, I don't find that nasty pranks by drunk teenagers really make my flesh creep. For the flesh-creeping effect, I need something a bit stronger. Something like, for example, the trial currently underway at Federal District Court in Manhattan of four men who planted what they thought were bombs outside two synagogues in New York City. They were also said to have been planning attacks against military aircraft. All four of the men have long criminal records, and they've all done jail time. Three of them are African Americans. The fourth is a Haitian national. All of them are Muslims. One of the African Americans had a Muslim father. The other three converted to Islam in prison under the guidance of Muslim prison chaplains. Now, when you talk about anti-Muslim feeling and petty incidents of the kind that I opened this segment with, the line that the multiculturalists come back with is this one. Ah, yes, they say. But you know, there was strong anti-Catholic feeling back in the mid-19th century. America rose above that, and Catholics are now fully accepted as patriotic citizens. True enough. But let me ask a few questions. One, when did Catholic terrorists slaughter 3,000 Americans and bring down landmark buildings? Two, when did radical Catholic priests worm their way into the prison services to recruit dim-witted underclass desperados to a worldwide conspiracy? Three, at which point in US history could you open up a respectable newspaper on pretty much any day of the week and read a news story about Catholic fanatics trying to blow up a plane, the subway, synagogues, or Times Square? Four, is what we're going through with Muslims just a replay of past religious discords in our history? Or is it something of a completely different magnitude and significance? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Item, if you're looking for some background to the federal suit that was announced this week against Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Arizona, try Byron York's August 6th piece in the Washington Examiner. It's one of the scariest things I've read recently. It concerns Thomas Perez, head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. Perez got a huge increase in appropriation in Obama's 2010 budget, and he's spending it, hiring lawyers and promising, quote, a huge increase in prosecution of alleged hate crimes. If you want to know which way liberty is going under the Obama regime, I urge you to read Byron's piece. Just go to WashingtonExaminer.com and search on Perez, P-E-R-E-Z. It's the third or fourth thing that comes up. Item, the biggest bank in Afghanistan is in trouble, with depositors hammering on the doors demanding their money. Apparently they've heard rumours that the bank is one humongous big ATM for the bank's major shareholders, one of whom is Mahmoud Karzai, brother of our loyal friend and trusted ally, Hamid Karzai. Why anyone should think such a thing, I simply can't imagine. Mahmoud Karzai rushed back to Afghanistan on news of the bank run from his home in Dubai, where he owns a magnificent waterfront villa. His suggestion to soothe the panicking depositors was that the US Treasury Department give the bank a bailout. My own alternative suggestion would be a little more radical. Without going into details, it involves Kabul city lampposts, lengths of sturdy rope, and people with the surname Karzai. However, I suspect that the bailout idea will win the day. Item, the Economic Policy Institute brought out a study titled The Five Fastest Growing Occupations. Here they are, with their median hourly wage. Food preparation and serving, $8.28. Home health aid, $9.85. Warehouse stock clerk, $10.08. Medical assistant, $13.77. Registered nurse, $30.65. So, there are your surefire career choices, you youngsters of America. You don't have to settle for being a food preparation worker making a bit less than $20,000 a year. You can stock shelves in a warehouse for a bit more than $20,000 a year. Failing that, it pretty much comes down to something in healthcare, the only really vigorous section of the economy. Oh, and by the way, it probably will fail that, because we just let in another 10 million Mexicans to do all the food prep and shelf stocking work. Have a nice day. Item. Although, contrary to that, here's a different study. Title. Employer Health Benefits 2010 Annual Survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation. What they found is that for the first time ever, American employers are passing increases in healthcare costs straight through to their employees, shouldering none of the increases themselves. Employee contributions were up 14% this year from last year. As America's salarymen are hit with ever higher premiums, you'll see a slowing in demand. In fact, it's already been noticed. So, perhaps better forget about healthcare and go for the warehouse stock clerk job, if you can get your name in before the Mexican guy. And finally, the Director General of the British Broadcasting Corporation has admitted that, quote, "In the BBC that I joined 30 years ago, there was a massive bias to the left." End quote. This news was greeted with shocked disbelief by Katie Couric, Dan Rather, Bryant Gumbel, Bill Moyers, and several other American TV news figures. Ms. Couric, speaking for them all, wondered how a respected broadcasting organization could ever permit itself to be infected by bias. And she added that the leftward tilt at the BBC must have been carried out with great subtlety, as she herself had never noticed it. Yes, it's certainly very shocking. Here at Radio Derb, known worldwide for our scrupulous impartiality, we can only share Miss Couric's surprise and bafflement. There we are, ladies and gents. We have survived another 7 days in the America of Obama, Pelosi and Reid. Or at any rate, those dwindling numbers of us, not yet hopelessly unemployed, wiped out by the falling markets, bankrupted by taxes, or sued by Eric Holder. It's only 2 months to the midterm, so hang on. Let's have something upbeat to see us out, Ahmed, please. No, Ahmed. Something non-Islamic, perhaps, if you don't mind. No offence at all to anyone, of course. Thank you.